We start in the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wal asr, innal insana lafi khusr. Illa allazina amanu wa amilus salihati wa tawasaw bil haqqi wa tawasaw bis sabr. In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, by the token of time, through the ages, verily man is doomed, mankind is doomed, except such as have faith and do righteous deeds and join together in the mutual propagation of truth and of patience and constancy. Sadaqallahu Mawlana Razim. Dear panelists, this is our third and last day of round table with Dr. Israr Ahmed. For the last 2 days, he has talked about the conceptual and more ideational ideas about Islam. And today he will talk about historical facts and realities on ground, with special reference to the subcontinent, Indo-Pakistan subcontinent. So the topic this morning is Islamic intellectual history in modern South Asia, with special reference to Pakistan, critical issues and perspectives. I request Dr. Israr Ahmed to make his discourse, please.
Ahmaduhu wa usalli ala rasulihi al-kareem. أما بعد فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم قال النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم إن الله يبعث في هذه الأمة على رأس كل 100 عام من يجدد لها دينها أو كما قال. Dear brothers and sisters from Adam and Eve, may Allah's grace and mercy be upon both of them, and may Allah bless all of us. Today's subject is, I think, too wide to be covered in 1 hour, but I'll try to be as brief as possible. Firstly, we should have to fix what we mean by modern age. Islamic intellectual history in modern South Asia. Where from to start it? Arbitrarily, I'm fixing it from the time the Britishers occupied India. But before we discuss to what were the influences after British occupation and what were the reactions among the Muslims of India, let me give you a preview, very brief, of Islam in the subcontinent. Islam entered the subcontinent first in the beginning of the 8th century of Christian era, or near the end of the 1st century of Hijri era, in 712-713 CE, when Muhammad bin Qasim invaded Sindh in reaction to a looting of an Arabic caravan by the people of Sindh and arresting and abducting a number of Muslim women. There was a demand from the Muslims to return the women and to make good the damages. But the Hindu Raja refused, Dahir. So there was an invasion. So this was an Islam, not of the prophetic days, not of the pious caliphate, because the pious caliphate, the guided caliphate, had ended half a century before this event. So the purest form of Islam didn't even touch the Indian subcontinent. But nevertheless, this Islam which came with the Arabs was purely Arab Islam. No external influences had yet entered the Islamic fold. This was pure Arabian Islam and simple. There were no sects, no schools of fiqh, jurisprudence, no schools of scholasticism, etc., etc. Simple. Quran and Sunnah. Quran and Sunnah. But this advent of Islam in South Asia was very brief, because the third era, which was prophesied by Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, had started. I narrated to you a hadith from the Prophet that this is my time. تَكُونُ النَّبُوَّةُ فِيكُمْ مَا شَاءَ اللَّهُ أَن تَكُونُ. Prophethood will remain with you so long as Allah wants it to remain. ثُمَّ يَرْفَعُ اللَّهُ إِذَا شَاءَ يَرْفَعُ. Then Allah will lift it up when He deems fit. That is, I will remain with you as long as Allah wishes. Then there will be a period of caliphate in the footsteps of prophethood. خِلَافَ عَلَى مِنْ هَذِي النُّبُوَّةِ. Exactly the same system will continue during this second period. But it will also remain, so long as Allah will like it to remain, then it will also be lifted. Then the third phase would be of cruel kingship. ثُمَّ تَكُونُ مُلْكًا عَظًّا. Biting kingship. So this third stage had already started when Islam entered the subcontinent. And that is why, because Muhammad bin Qasim was very, very, very successful here, and due to his piety, the Hindus here made idols for him and started worshipping him. Seeing that a person is becoming so popular with the masses, and it could be a threat to the king sitting over there in Damascus, so he was recalled and killed. And with that, there was the coming back of this era very soon. So this stage was very short-lived. Now Islam entered this subcontinent from the northwest through Afghanistan 300 years after this invasion of Sindh. During these 300 years, 3 centuries, many external influences had entered Islam. The Greek logic, Greek philosophy, Neoplatonic mysticism. So to say, it was Arabian, Iranian, and Turkish Islam which came to the subcontinent. A mixture of three. Originally Arab, then the Iranian, Persian, and then the Turkish. What were the main features of this Islam? Number one, Quran had receded in the background, faded background. Why? Number one, because when Islam entered from the stage of struggle and jihad, the revolutionary struggle, into a state, now a state was established. So now law became more important than the inspiration from Quran. This is a natural change. Number two, when there was monarchy, there was, you know, people were loving wealth, gathering, accumulating wealth, absentee landlordism. So the people at the helm of affairs didn't want that people should read Quran. They will see the real picture of Islam. And in that mirror, if they will look upon us, there will be a negative influence. So consciously, Quran was taken back, on the back burner. Instead, hadith and fiqh, the jurisprudence, they were the focus of attention. Four schools, big schools of fiqh, rather five we can say, had been established till that time. But the school of fiqh that came into Indian subcontinent was Hanafi, the one started by Imam Abu Hanifa. Then there had been invented Ilmul Kalam, scholasticism, the Mu'tazili, the Ash'ari, Al-Maturidi, and a mixture of this also was imported into the subcontinent. Then there was a mysticism, and it had Neoplatonic influences in it, externally. So there was also an integral part of this Islam which entered subcontinent round about the 10th century of Christian era. And this was the condition. From that time till the 18th century, there were Muslim rulers, there were muftis, legal people who can give legal opinion, fatwas, there were qazis, magistrates, deciding the disputes and affairs according to the Sharia. And there were the khatibs in the mosque to deliver the khutbah of Jum'ah, Friday. And they were also paid by the government, not independent. These three positions were government positions, bureaucratic positions. Khatib in the mosque, Jami mosque. There used to be an ordinary mosque for five prayers a day. No khutbah, no lecture whatsoever. No sermon. The sermon was restricted to Friday. And that was delivered by the people appointed by the government. Just as we have today in Turkey, and we have today in Saudi Arabia, etc., etc. So, there were kings, there were these ulama, and you know everyone had with his name Hanafi and either Qadri or Naqshbandi. These were the schools of the mysticism. Now this was the condition when the British entered India from Bengal, eastern end. After the coming and conquest of India by the Britishers, the division between state and religion, which had already taken place, the political power was with those who had might. Might was right. A tribe is stronger, he will take. Babur was stronger, he defeated Ibrahim Lodi and he became the emperor here. It has nothing to do with religion whatsoever. The religion was with the khatibs, with the qazis, with the muftis. But now you know this division became more apparent because the British were ruling. And if I use my own terminology, now the deen was of the Britishers and Islam was reduced absolutely to the position of a mazhab religion. You can have your own beliefs, okay, we don't object. You can have your modes of worship, five prayers, keeping fast in the month of Ramadan, go ahead. Even personal law, yes, you can practice your own personal law. But the criminal code, civil code, taxation, all these things would be ours. Along with the Britishers came two things. Christianity, the first center of the propagation of Christianity was in Bengal. Bible was translated into Urdu. And it was spread like anything. The government was doing it. And number two, a civilization, the Western civilization came. Number three, English language and physical sciences and Western thought. These things came in India. Now to this situation, there were two reactions from among the Muslim intellectuals of India. I have discussed this thing in detail in one of my pamphlets, Islamic Renaissance, the Real Task Ahead. So, I would request you to go through that pamphlet. There were two reactions, as I said.
Tell the name again, Islamic
Renaissance or Renaissance. The Real Task Ahead. The first reaction was purely defensive. Based on the pragmatic view that we are not in a position to attack on these new influences that are coming. Western thought, Western civilization. And especially the physical sciences. Hence we should go and sit in the corners and keep with us the Quran and the Sunnah and the Fiqh, trying to keep them alive for the next generations to come, lest they wash off permanently. This was the reaction of some ulama, and especially on this basis, seminary of Deoband that was established. And that was actually a defensive mechanism. We won't learn English, we won't read science, we won't take up the Western civilization, we won't use the spoons and forks which are coming with them, we won't dine on a table. All these things, we will just boycott. Number two, the ulama, some of them, they came into politics also. Firstly, it was a politics for getting freedom from the Britishers, freedom movements. And it was a great freedom movement led by Congress along with Jamiatul Ulama-e Hind, an organization of the Muslim learned people of India. And this potential school of thought then later on take the form of a movement in the shape of Tablighi Jama'ah. I hope you people are aware, because Tablighis going to Europe, going to America, a very big congregation in very close to Lahore, more than 1 million people, they gather here, more than 3 million people, just equal to the people who perform Hajj every year, they gather in Dhaka, Tongi. It's a big movement. So this concept of Islam as a mazhab has taken the form of a movement, spreading the Islamic beliefs and focusing on personal piety and performing all the rituals and the ceremonies of Islam, the modes of worship, having an appearance of a Muslim regarding clothings and regarding their faces, beards and their hair. So this is the movement, Tablighi Jamaat, which represent the same concept of Mazhab. But it is dynamic, very dynamic. The second reaction was more logical, so to say. That no, we can't boycott what is coming, whatever is new. We have to confront it. Whatever is correct and right and true, we must accept. Whatever is wrong, we should reject. So this was the attitude taken by a very dynamic person, Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan, who established first a school, then a college, then a university, the Aligarh University. We shall teach English and Arabic. We shall teach sciences, modern social sciences also. And we will teach Islamiyat also. So this was the way taken by the majority of the Muslims of India. But the second reaction in the very beginning was wrongly directed, although it was essentially correct. Why the people who took to this path, they were overawed by the Western civilization, Western thinking, and especially this physics, the science, although that was science of Newtonian era, physics was in its infancy up till that time, but they were overawed and felt defeated. So they looked to Islam, and whatever didn't appear to them to fit in this new, they just chopped it off. For example, Sir Sayyid Ahmad said, there is no existence of angels. What Quran calls angels are the natural forces of the universe, that's all. No personified existence of angels. There are no jinns. Only people who get easily flared up, they are called that they are made of fire. They are the uncivilized people. They are jinns. They tried to have an explanation, physical explanation, scientific explanation of the miracles about the breaking of the sea at the time of Moses, alayhi salatu wasalam. They said it was tide and ebb. When the ocean was on the ebb, Moses and the children of Israel, they crossed over. And so on and so forth. So to say, scientific explanations, so that it can fit in the modern mind, to make it fit to the modern mind. Now the people who took to this path, most of the people, because if they read English, they could get the services in the government, they could be employed. Otherwise not. If they have to learn engineering and medicine, etc., etc., they have to go through that education system. So most of the Western educated elite of the Muslims of South Asia belong to this category. The beginner was Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan, but then so many people carried this flag. Allama Mashraqi, then the Qadianis, the physical explanations, scientific explanations, acceptable to the modern man. And there are people who refuse to give due importance to the tradition of the Prophet. People who refute Hadith. We shall follow only Quran. And we shall interpret Quran as we like, according to our own understanding, without any reference to what the Prophet said. What the Prophet has been supposed to have said, we can never be sure. So these are the shades, but the source was Sir Sayyid Ahmad. But this process, Brother Roger will again appreciate, thesis and antithesis brought a synthesis. Synthesis in the person of Allama Iqbal. He clung to the fundamentals of Islam and Iman. And he studied, he read English, he studied philosophy, the old as well as modern. He went to England, Germany, got his PhD from Germany, bar at law from England. And you know, through his poetry, mostly, he represented true Islam. And not only true Islam, but also a critique, very severe, deep critique of the Western civilization. Now this movement, Sir Sayyid Khan and Iqbal, this now took the form of a Muslim nationalist movement, political movement in India. Muslims are a separate nation. They are not one nation with the Hindus. Our culture is different. Our lifestyles are different. Our beliefs are different. Everything is different. We are not one nation. Our nationhood is not based on land, on a country. The position of the Hindus was that we are all Indians. We are one nation. We should be united to get freedom from the Britishers, etc., etc. But this Muslim nationalist movement tried to get the safeguards from Congress that our rights will be fully preserved and protected. Qaid-e-Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah remained a biggest banner holder, standard bearer of this Hindu-Muslim unity and amicability. But he was disappointed by Hindu mentality. And due to his very long, a very close association with the Hindu leadership of India, he came to the conclusion that we can't expect justice from them. And they are in a great majority. If this country gets freedom as one country, we'll be doomed. There is enmity in the hearts of the Hindus because the Muslims have governed them. Somewhere for 1,000 years, somewhere for 800 years, somewhere for 600 years. There was a reaction. And not all the Muslim rulers were pious. Some of them were pious also, no doubt. But not all of them. When the Prophet said, cruel kinship. So kinship was there. This, all the evils of kingship were there. So this movement flourished. And then it took the shape of Pakistan movement. We must have a separate country in the subcontinent so that we can establish Islam. Our own religion, our own social order, our own political system, our own economic system, our own criminal law, our own civil law. We want that India be partitioned on the basis of this religion. Wherever Muslims are in majority in the northwest of India and the northeast of India, they should be a separate country and the rest of India should be separate. And because the slogan of religion was invoked, the slogan was, Pakistan ka matlab kya? La ilaha illallah. What Pakistan means? La ilaha illallah. There's no God except Allah. And we want to establish the deen of Allah. Iqbal said in his lecture of 1930, presidential address of the annual session of All India Muslim League, he said, it is destiny that an independent Muslim state will be established in the northwest of India. And if that happens, we shall have an opportunity, a chance, to remove the bad dots on the face of Islam, which appeared during the period of imperialism, kingship, whether the Umayyad or the Abbasid, to remove those and show to humanity at large the real face of Islam. This is Islam. We would establish Islam. And the same was said by Qaid-e-Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah. We need Pakistan to show to the world at large, humanity at large, a model of the Islamic principles of the same three words used by H.G. Wells: human equality, fraternity, and freedom. Islamic principles. Islamic interpretations of human fraternity, equality, and freedom. Now, leaving this issue here, I'm coming to another subject which was going on side by side. It's the other dimension. And for that, I quoted the hadith in the beginning. The Prophet said, and we believe in it, that the chain of prophethood which started with Adam, alayhi salatu wassalam, he was also a prophet. The first man and the first prophet. And there is a chain of thousands of prophets. The recorded prophets are only, which we find in the Old Testament, and then the New Testament, Jesus and Muhammad. But there are prophets have been sent to all regions of the world. But Quran is giving the history of only those who appeared in that area, region. Because otherwise they should have been taught first geography and history and, you know, all the countries. No. But this chain of prophets and messengers of Allah has come to an end, and its climax, its zenith, in the prophethood and messengerhood of Muhammad. We accept Noah, we accept Abraham, along with so many others. But the five, according to us, the five most important messengers of Allah have been Noah, number one, Abraham, number two, Moses, number three, Jesus, number four, and fifth and final, Muhammad, alayhi salatu wassalam. Now, after this institution of prophethood and messengerhood coming to an end, Allah gave a promise to Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam that he will keep on raising from among Muslims mujaddids. Mujaddid means renewer, reviver. You may call reformers. They are not prophets. These, you know, Allah has promised, the Prophet said, that for in this ummah, he will raise mujaddids, renewers of Islam, Islamic faith and Islamic practices, and washing it off from the external influences which might have come through that century, 100 years, making it pure Islam regarding the faith and the practices in every century. Now, for the first 1,000 years of Islamic history, or Muslim history, I should say, all the mujaddids appeared in the Arab world. Umar bin Abdul Aziz, who revived caliphate for a short period and finished this that monarchy of the Umayyads and the landlordship, etc., etc. Then Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Malik, Imam Shafi, so on and so forth, Imam Ghazali, Imam Ibn Taymiyyah, Shaykh Abdul Qadir Jilani, these are all Mujaddids. Ahmad Ibn Hanbal, a great Mujaddid. But the strange fact is that no sooner than the 2,000 years started, from 11th century Hijra, this institution of Mujaddideen was shifted to the South Asia. First of all, Ahmad Sarhandi, Mujaddid al-Fasani, the Mujaddid of the 2,000 years, because it had started. What he did? He washed away the influences that came against Islam during the time of the great Mughal Emperor Akbar, Akbar the Great. He said, and he was advised by some ulama, his court, belonging to his court, that Allah's one day is equal to our 1,000 years. This is twice appeared, this thing in Quran. One day of Allah is, according to your calendar, it is 1,000 years. So Islam of Muhammad was for 1,000 years only. Now that 1,000 years has come to an end, now a new religion is required. And I am giving you the new religion called Deen-e-Ilahi. Only keeping the Prophet aside. He tried to join, take something from Hinduism, take something from Buddhism, take something from Islam, and mix it up and make it a new deen. It was actually politically motivated. He knew that the subcontinent is a very big power, very big force, but the hurdles in its coming up in the world is this division on the basis of religion. So there has to be amalgamated all these things together and a mixture provided. And actually, it was the rejection of the Sharia of Muhammad. And you know, the identity of the Ummah was based on the Sharia. So bypassing the prophethood, now Islam is gone. It loses its identity. Secondly, at the same time, I told you when Islam entered subcontinent, there was mysticism. It has both elements, Islamic mysticism, yes, but the Neoplatonic element. Here it got influence from the Hindu mysticism also. And now when these mysticisms, they came together, the result was sort of pantheism. Pantheism is just contrary to Islam. Islam is based on Tawheed, he is alone. This universe is his creation. Not a part of his person, not at all. So under this pantheistic, although the Wahdatul Wujud, unity of being of Ibn Arabi is somewhat different. Wahdatul Shahud of Ahmad Sarhandi is somewhat different. But upon the masses, the influence was that of pantheism, pantheistic mysticism. And Islam was going to be lost. And I may bring to your attention that India is very famous in this, Hindus. They assimilated any religion, putting an end to that religion, assimilating it into their own religion. What to speak of any religion which had come from outside? Even Buddhism was born in India. It was finished. Now you go and see it in Thailand or somewhere, you know, far east, southeast. In India there is no Buddhism. Although Buddha was born there, he preached there. In the same way, Hindu Mat wanted that Islam should also be absorbed and finish its identity as a separate religion. Now these two things, one coming politically from the emperor, Mughal the great Mughal, and the other coming from mysticism. All these influences were washed away by this Mujaddid of the 11th century of Hijra, Shaykh Ahmad Sarhandi. And the identity of Muslim Ummah was preserved. And the maximum emphasis now came on following the Prophet. And Iqbal in his footsteps says, Mustafa barasanhi shraqidi hamaus. Agar bauna rasidi tamam bulabist. Take yourself to the feet of Muhammad. Because Islam is but Muhammad. Nothing but Muhammad. And if you not go to him, it's all falsehood, Mulahbist, the infidel uncle of Muhammad, Abu Lahab, who was the bitterest enemy of Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. So this was re-established. Then came in the next century, a great intellectual giant, that was Shah Waliullah of Delhi. He, one person, can be equated with the whole team in Europe who revived the knowledge. He is so big a personality. First of all, he revived all the Islamic sciences and knowledge from its ultimate sources. As I told you, Quran had receded into background. Because the court language during this Islamic rule in India was Persian, not Arabic. I told you this Islam was a mixture of Arabism and Iranianism and Turkishism. So, Quran had preceded people, they didn't know what Quran is saying. Therefore, they recited it to get some sawab, we call it, some reward in the hereafter, because we are reciting and reading the word of Allah and the book of Allah. That's all. People didn't know what is written in it. They revered Quran, they respected it, they loved it, they honored it, recited it, but they didn't know. Even to the extent that among the ulama, it was a sin to translate the Quran into any other language. It was this intellectual giant who started translation of Quran himself into Persian, because that was the court language. And then his three sons into Urdu. One only gave a translation. The second one gave a translation of his own with some explanatory notes. The third one wrote a full exegesis. We call it tafsir of Quran. So back to Quran. The original source of knowledge. This process, back to Quran, ruju ila al-Quran, go back to Quran. This started in the 12th century after Hijra by no less a person than Shah Waliullah Dehlvi. The real spirit of Quran and the emphasis is put on jihad. I told you. Quran says there can be no salvation without jihad. There can be no iman without jihad. When Quran was opened, now jihad came into the focus. So in the 13th century of Hijra, now the Mujaddid was Sayyid Ahmad Barelvi, the same Sayyid, Ahmad, احمد سرہندی، احمد بریلوی، سید احمد بریلوی، اینڈ ہز مین لیفٹیننٹ واز دی گرینڈ سن آف شاہ ولی اللہ شاہ اسماعیل. دے ویجڈ اے کیمپین اسٹرگل، دی پرپز واز ٹو آؤس دی برٹشرز فرام انڈیا اینڈ ریٹرن اینڈ میک انڈیا اگین دارالاسلام، بیکاز مسلمز آر رولنگ اٹ. دے سنیچ پاور فرام اس. بٹ اسٹریٹجیکلی ہی اسٹارٹڈ ہز جہاد اور قتال، آئی شوڈ سے ہیئر، فرام دی نارتھ ویسٹ فرنٹیئر ایریا، بیکاز دیئر دی ہنٹر لینڈ واز اسلامک، افغانستان، گو ٹو افغانستان، ایران، ترکستان، اینڈ پنجاب یو نو واز ایٹ دیٹ ٹائم آکوپائڈ بائی سکھس اینڈ دے ور پرسیکیوٹنگ مسلمز بیڈلی. ہی مائگریٹڈ ٹو دی نارتھ ویسٹ فرنٹیئر پروونس، بٹ ہی کمیٹڈ اے مسٹیک. He, as soon as reached there, he established Islamic State, enforced Sharia in full. The local population resented. They had their own customs, pukhtuns, their social customs. So there was a revolt from within. People betrayed him. So many people who came with him from as far as Bengal, Bihar, UP, these were the three most important provinces of India from which people joined hands with Sayyid Ahmad Bareilvi. As a result, he failed. He was martyred in 1831 at Balakot. It's about 200 miles to the northwest of Lahore. But he revived the spirit of jihad. In the 14th century, we had Shaykhul Hind, Maulana Mahmood Hassan of Deoband. He again started a freedom movement. But he wanted help from Afghanistan and from Darul Khilafa, Turkey. If we get help from there and from inside India we stand up in revolt, we can make the Britishers run from here. That attempt also failed. But this process and this lineage of Mujaddids have left impression on the general mind of Muslims of the subcontinent. Maybe you call it the collective subconscious of the Muslims in India has the influences of Shaykh Ahmad Sarhandi, Shah Waliullah Dehlavi, Sayyid Ahmad Bareilvi and Shaykhul Hind. Now we come to the 20th century. In the 20th century, the subcontinent produced four very important intellectual leaders. Four and foremost, Iqbal. He had the educational background, modern, a PhD in philosophy from Munich, bar at law from London, a philosopher and a poet, great philosopher and a great poet. Number one, he added to the mission of Shah Waliullah, which was started by Shah Waliullah, calling Muslims back to Quran, back to Quran, back to Quran. He said that the basic cause that we are being humiliated in this world today is that we have turned our backs to Quran. لَقْتُبِي خَاهِ مُسْلِمَ عَزِيزْتَنِ نِيسْتْ مُمْكِنْ ذِلْبَ قُرْآنَ عَزِيزْتَنِ If you want to live as Muslims, it's impossible without Quran. So return to Quran. Then he initiated new ilm-e-kalam. The ilm-e-kalam of Ghazali and ilm-e-kalam of others, Razi, etc. was now obsolete. Why? Because that was the ilm-ul-kalam based on the Greek logic and philosophy. Trying to fill the gap between Islamic aqaid and dogma and the Aristotelian logic and Greek philosophy. But now, the philosophy had gone into the background. It was the era of science, physical sciences. Now the need of the hour was to bridge the gap between Quran and the physical sciences. This process was started by Allama Iqbal in his poetry as well as his lectures, six lectures. The collection of these six lectures, but they are seven actually. The title is Reconstruction of Religious Thought in Islam. Reconstruction. Note this word. Reconstruction of Religious Thought in Islam. On the basis of modern psychology, modern epistemology, modern physics. But he was also, although he was an idealist, a thinker, a philosopher. The most accurate picture of his photo is this. Sitting, contemplating, holding his head by the forehead. This is the exact representation of his personality. But he was alive to the facts on the ground also. What threat was coming by Hindu majority in the subcontinent who are full of revenge. They want to take revenge from Muslims because they ruled over them for near a century. And this fear, you know, was expressed by Indira Gandhi. Although she was the granddaughter of Motilal Nehru, a very civilized person, he said, when he was asked, what is your religion, what can I tell you? By language, I am a Muslim. By birth, I am a Hindu. By civilization, I am a Westerner, European. And now, you know, father of Indira Gandhi, he was a socialist, very broad-minded, secular. But the granddaughter of Motilal and daughter of Jawaharlal, when Dhaka fell and Pakistan was torn apart into two pieces, she said, we have avenged our 1,000 years defeat. That is the Hindu psyche. We have avenged our 1,000 years defeat. So this condition Iqbal was seeing. And I have already quoted his presidential address to the All India Muslim League session of Allahabad in December 1930. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, till that time I told you, he was striving hard to have unity among Muslims and Hindus. Only that the Hindus should promise, give a solemn pledge that our rights will be preserved. But then he was disappointed. He left the political arena of India, went to London, settled there, started his legal practice. But in 1932, Iqbal went there for the second roundtable conference and met him. At that time, Iqbal injected into him the concept of Islamic revival. Actually, protection of Muslims was a negative attitude based on fear. But to divide Islam and to show to the world a model of Islamic State. That was the positive purpose. He injected it. And he persuaded him to come back to India and lead the Muslims. From that time onwards till his death, he was repeating this lesson given to him by Iqbal. Islam, Islam, Islam. And because the emotions, sentiments of the Muslim masses, due to these four mujaddids, they might not be practicing Muslims, but they had the influence in the subconscious mind, collective subconscious mind, of the concept of the revival of Islam. They gathered together under the banner of Muslim League. And the election of 1946, Muslim League came out as the sole representative of the Muslims of India. This could not be put off, bypassed in any solution of the future of India after independence. It had a say. Now, leaving here, now I come to, along with Iqbal, we had three more very important persons. Number two was Abul Kalam Azad, who died in 1958 as the Education Minister of India. He was influenced and inspired by the poetry of Iqbal. In 1913, he established a party called Hizbullah, the Party of Allah. And he stated that aim of this party is to establish the kingdom of Allah on earth. I may say kingdom of heaven on earth, but it was Hukumat-e-Ilahiya, kingdom of Allah on earth. And it was based on Bay'ah. Bay'ah means oath of personal allegiance. I accept you as my leader, I will obey. Within the parameters of the Sharia, if you give me some commandment order which contravenes the Sharia, I won't accept. I won't obey. But if it is within the parameters of the Sharia, I will accept. I will obey. I'll give you my opinion, my advice, but the decision will not be made through majority vote of the party. The decision will rest with you personally. This is Bay'ah, the institution for the basis of organization in Islam, which is mentioned in Quran, in Hadith, in Sirah, life of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But till that time, the orthodox ulama, I have told you before, that they had a limited concept of Islam as a mazhab only. Actually, the revolutionary concept of Islam was revived by Iqbal, saying that this is deen, not mazhab. There can be no dichotomy between mazhab and deen and siyasat. Juda ho din siyasat se to reh jati hai Changezi. If our politics is separate from our religion, then it is all tyranny, not Islam. But on that basis, the first practical attempt was made by Abul Kalam Azad. He was very close to Shaykhul Hind also. So these two influences worked on him. The Mujaddid of the 14th century Hijra, Shaykhul Hind, Maulana Mahmood Hassan, and Allama Iqbal. The reviver of the revolutionary concept of Islam. But because I told you, the ulama in general were sticking to that limited concept of mazhab. There is a very incisive couplet of Iqbal. I'm sorry you can't appreciate it. By translation, you know, that real spirit cannot be transmitted. Mullah ko jo hai Hind mein sajde ki ijazat, nada ye samajhta hai ki Islam hai azad. The Maulvi, the Mullah, because he is allowed by the Britishers, you can pray, you can keep fast, he thinks that Islam is free. Islam is not free. Islam as a deen is downtrodden under the feet of the Britishers. Mullah ko jo hai Hind mein sajde ki ijazat, nada ye samajhta hai ki Islam hai azad. Islam is not free. It will only be free when it is established as a deen. So I told you that ulama rejected him, and frustrated by this attitude of the ulama, he wound up and then joined Indian National Congress for the struggle for independence. In 1920, for 7 years he was working under Hizbullah, and he also added to the call for going back to Quran. He also did it. Then a few years after this rolling of the bed of Hizbullah, appeared Maulana Maududi on the scene. Accumulating the influences of Abul Kalam, of Iqbal, he established Jamaat Islami in 1941. The sole objective which was stated in the beginning was the same word, Hukumat-e-Ilahiya, Kingdom of Allah. He borrowed it from Abul Kalam Azad. But later on, when a Quranic scholar joined his hands with him, then the term was adopted, Iqamatuddin, to establish the deen of Allah. It is derived from an ayah of Quran, Aqimuddin, it's your duty, O Muslims, to establish the deen of Allah. Now, along with Jamaat Islami, talking about India, but it must be noted that it was a pan-Islamic sort of thought. These movements were contemporary, starting from Indonesia, Muslimi Party, India, Jamaat Islami, Iran, Fidayeen, and from Egypt started the big movement of Al-Fadl Muslimun. Nearly the same thought. And this thought came to the surface on the basis of the ending of the colonial rule. Now when we are free, we should practice our Islam as a total deen. So these movements started nearly simultaneously. Nobody could succeed anywhere. Maududi also failed badly. Maulana Maududi also contributed to that movement of going back to Quran. He wrote an exegesis of Quran, keeping in view especially the modern educated people, to reach their minds, their brain. And he expounded the politico-socio-economic system of Islam. This is the Islamic state, and I take him and accept him till today, although I left his Jama'ah about half a century before. But till this date, I admit the greatest political thinker of Islam of the 20th century was Maududi. I quoted that he coined that term of theodemocracy. He wasn't. His writings on the concept of Islamic State, they are, I think, till date, till today, the best and most comprehensive. His thoughts about social system of Islam were also 100% correct, and I agree with them. Only regarding the economic system, he remained somewhat backward. He could recognize the evilness of interest on cash, but not the interest on land, absentee landlordism. He declared it to be lawful, which I told you was declared by Abu Hanifa as haram, forbidden. By Imam Malik, forbidden. By Shafi, forbidden in open field, only allowed when there is some crop under a garden, but not in the open field. So this was his shortcoming. He was short of the spirit of the time. For the revival of Islam, these things have to be made clear. Number two, but here, before I go to number two, I must accept that by and large, his exposition of Islamic system of life is correct. And he did it in a very simple language, easy, and using the terminology of the time, so that he could reach the minds of the modern educated people, in which he succeeded. I myself, one of his followers. But what were the lacking points? Number one, I told you, absentee landlordism. Number two, all his emphasis was on Islam as a politico-socio-economic system, not on Iman. The basis of Islam is Iman. The living faith, the burning faith, the personal conviction in the existence of Allah and His attributes, His unity. Burning faith in the life hereafter, that is the real life, not this. The emphasis on Iman was not there. As if it was taken for granted. Just as the religious movements, the other, they take it for granted because he is a Muslim, he is a woman. No. That is why I started my second lecture was the difference between Islam and Iman. So no movement, Islamic movement can succeed unless it succeeds in taking the roots of Iman to the depths of the heart of the hearts of the people. So this was his primary mistake. I have discussed about it in that pamphlet, Islamic Renaissance. But when he came over to Pakistan, for 6 years he was true to his methodology that he enunciated, derived from the seerah and life of Muhammad. He kept true. He kept away from the Muslim nationalist movement, Pakistan movement. He said, if this movement succeeds, another Muslim nation state would come, not Islam. Because the people who are running this movement, they are not practicing Muslims even. Qadi Azam was not a practicing Muslim. The majority of the leadership of Muslim League were not practicing Muslims. So another Muslim state would be added to already existing. To form and establish Islamic state, you have to follow a special strategy and methodology to be derived from the methodology of Muhammad. But when he came over to Pakistan after partition, for 3-4 years he retained his revolutionary ideology and revolutionary methodology. And the first achievement was that he now owned, co-opted the slogan of Muslim League. Why do we want Pakistan? For Islam. Using that sentiment and slogan, he said, now because Islam, Pakistan has been established on this basis, the constitutional foundation of this state should be on Islam. He edited a demand, and this demand, his party, although very small party, but very active, very committed people, they propagated it, demand. And all the Muslims supported it. Even the sincere Muslim Leagues, they supported it. The result was that the objectives resolution was passed in 1949, which stated, I told you the first principle of Islamic State is the sovereignty belongs to God. It is in clear words, sovereignty is for Allah. We have no claim over sovereignty. All the powers or authority that we have is a sacred trust to be used within the limits of the Sharia, book of Allah and the tradition of His Prophet. So it was a big success. And so to say, the foundation stone of Khilafah was established. Then there was a hue and cry. Whose Islam will you establish? The Shia Islam, the Sunni Islam, the Brahmi Islam, the Deobandi Islam? Whose Islam? Then the other great achievement was of the ulama. 31 ulama gathered at Karachi, representing all the sects, all shades of opinion. And they adopted 22 principles of Islamic constitution and agreed upon by all, Shia, Sunnis, Brahmis, Deobandis, Al-Hadis, Jamaat Islami, and so on and so forth. The top leadership. To silence those who were objecting, whose Islam will you enforce? But the very next year, Maulana Maududi committed the biggest blunder, Himalayan blunder of his life. He thought that we had adopted the slogan of Muslim League, Pakistan for Islam, and we started a movement of demand of the constitution on that basis, and we succeeded. Now if we enter the election arena with this slogan, we shall be returned to power, and then we shall use the whole government machinery to change the thinking pattern of the people, to reform them Islamically, etc., etc. So he decided to enter the power politics arena of this country by participating in elections in 1951. And that was the biggest blunder. He realized only after 20 years that he had committed a mistake. In 1971. But at that time he was too old. He couldn't hold the reins of power of the movement in his own hands and lead the movement. Anyhow, what happened with this was, please note my words, that Jamaat-e-Islami, which was before that an ideological Islamic revolutionary party, turned into an Islam-loving, national, political parties. These three, verses three. Ideological Islamic Revolutionary Party. It was changed into an Islam-loving but national political party. Now, I was, from my very early, I should say, when I was only a fifth class student, I started reading Iqbal. I was influenced by his poetry. That was the first impression. Then I was impressed by Maududi and Abul Kalam. When I also migrated to Pakistan from India, I joined Jamaat-e-Islami's movement. Firstly, the student section, Islami Jamaat al-Talba. And I rose to the position of the Nazim-e-Ala of Jamaat al-Talba. But then I came to the conclusion that Jamaat-e-Islami has taken a wrong turn. It's no more an Islamic revolutionary party. And this is going to be doomed. So I parted my ways after writing a note of dissent comprising 225 pages in a book now. It is now in a book form. An analysis of the movement of Jamaat-e-Islami. What it was originally and what it became after the independence of Pakistan. Now I myself, I told you, under the influence of Iqbal, Maududi, Abul Kalam, I started Tanzeem-e-Islami. I started my mission in 1965 independently. My first emphasis was on Iman through Quran. First, the foundations of Iman have to be taken down. Down in the heart. They take a nation's pillar deep. What is that couplet of English poetry? Not gold, but only men can make a people great and strong. So, to take Islam, Iman, to the depths of the heart, through Quran. Quran gives you a faith with an intellectual element. Faith, not a blind faith, but a faith with understanding, with an intellectual element. And most of my time has been spent in this. I found Markazi Anjuman Khuddamul Quran, the Central Society of the Servants of the Quran, on the pattern of the Society of the Servants of Bible. That was established in 1972. Then 3 years later I established Tanzeem-e-Islami, taking the same original pattern of Jamaat-e-Islami, differing only in two things. I revived the institution of Bay'ah. It's not a Western type constitution-based organization where the leaders are elected. No. The leader is the one who has called you for this ideal and this. He is the leader. And you have to give your bay'ah, your oath of allegiance to him. You can advise him, you can give your opinions, but the decision will not be by the counting of your votes, but the decision will rest with the Amir. I think this pamphlet is also included in that set. The institution of Bay'ah, the foundation of organization in Islam. The Prophet took Bay'ah, the Caliphs took Bay'ah, even the kings took Bay'ah, the Sufis for the purification of souls took Bay'ah, Mehdi Sodani when he was fighting against the Britishers took Bay'ah, Sanusi in Libya based on Bay'ah, Sayyid Ahmad Brevi Bay'ah, Imam Shamil Bay'ah. What? This is the basic foundation of Islamic organization. And number three, I have further cleared or formulated the methodology of Islamic revolution derived from the seerah of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It was a great blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gave me the strength to write this book. Islam cannot be established as a deen except by the methodology inferred, derived from the methodology of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And that is going to be the subject of my talk in the evening. Now my organization, Tanzeem Islami, I have, due to old age, given up the Imarat and leadership of the party. And I have nominated. Here we have nominations, no elections. A new leader has been nominated. I am there now as his honorary member. I obey him now, although he is my son. But he is Amir. So the response that we have got up till this date and time is very limited. The general religious scene is occupied mostly by the sectarian ulama's groups. Sectarian, based on sects. And then these two movements, Tablighi Jamaah and Jamaat Islami, as a political party. So they are dominating the scene up till now. Our progress is slow but steady. And out is with Allah, His decision and command. But this movement has now entered the second generation. And inshallah, it will continue. The success or otherwise is in His hands. Our duty is to strive and try to be on the right path. The success, when and through whom it comes, is for Allah to decide. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the close attention.
Short break. We'll take a short break for... Dear panelists, you have heard Dr. Sarr's discourse on a very vast subject. It has covered centuries, in fact, the arrival of Islam in the subcontinents, and then its development, and finally, the creation of Pakistan in 1947, and its aftermath. Now the floor is open for discussion.
I have a point of clarification initially. You mentioned that in the 20th century there are four mujaddids.
First of all, I never used the word mujaddid for them. Mujaddids were Ahmad Sarhandi, Shah Waliullah, Sayyid Ahmad Barelvi and Shaykhul Hind Maulana Mahmood Hassan.
Right.
But four, you may say, da'is and callers.
That's what I was not sure about. Now, the question that I have is a question, a comparative one, in relation to Badia Zaman Said Nursi in the Ottoman Empire, who was born in 1877. And briefly about his life is that after World War I, after the defeat of the Ottoman army, he began to preach the idea that the only way, the only destiny for Islam in the Ottoman Empire, in Turkey, as well as in the Muslim world, is the preservation of faith, Iman, as you have suggested. He has the same ideas about Iman. And that's why he went in full force to preserve Iman in a secular Turkish Republic, the Turkish Republic of Turkey that was established after 1924. And he never thought about re-establishing the Islamic socio-economic and political system. To him, that was part of his old days, the old Said. But his major intention was to preserve Iman in a new age. Now, you seem to be somewhat different. You seem to be saying that Iman alone is not sufficient, but it has to be reconstituted in the context of the state. Whereas for Said Nursi, he is saying that Iman without an Islamic state can be preserved, even in the most radical secular entity, such as the Turkish Republic of Turkey today.
Yes, the last thing that you have said, I agree 100%. Iman can be preserved. We have the example of the Ashab al-Kahf, people of the cave. They saved their Iman by running off from the society and hiding in a cave for 300 years, more than 300 years. So I would compare Sayyid Nursi's movement to Deobandis, the ulama, the big people who based Deoband. They wanted to preserve the Iman as Aqidah and, you know, the knowledge of Quran and Sunnah. But this phenomenon is actually exclusive. Iqbal was the first to revive the concept of Islam as a deen. And then, you know, first attempt was made by Abul Kalam, second by Maududi. And it is progressing. And I quote the ayah from the Quran, for you especially, لَتَرْكَبُنَّ طَبَقًا عَنْ طَبَقٍ. The big purpose which was achieved by the Prophet in 20 years, that cannot be achieved in one generation now. لَتَرْكَبُنَّ طَبَقًا عَنْ طَبَقٍ. We shall rise from level to level to level. And now we are very, very near, very close to that final end, inshallah.
I'd like to ask you a question about science, natural science. But let me first say, I enjoyed your talk more than any other talks which I've also enjoyed. I thought this was the best one for me that was, so thank you for that. It was a rich discussion. I want to ask you about the role of Western science. Science is the very basis of our technology, and the philosophy behind science and technology is secular. It has a long history of becoming secular. It is the dominance of our science and technology which has led to our imperial domination. Without it, we would not have achieved that domination over some 200 or 300 years, which has happened. And it is the ownership and control of that science and technology which forms today the military technology which is still totally dominant around the world. So my question is around the role of science in your Renaissance, in the Islamic Renaissance. You have mentioned it time and again in this talk today, but it is not clear to me what relation Islam has to Western natural science.
In one of my previous talks, I specified there are two knowledges. One is acquired, one is revealed. And this acquired knowledge is also Islamic. Because we are studying the universe, which is the work of God. The Quran, the scriptures, the Torah, the Bible, they are words of God. So there is no distinction or agreement between the two. If we find that there is someone, it is due to our knowledge, lack of knowledge. So we have to adopt it. It is not un-Islamic at all. It is Islamic. But thought governs this. This is not the governing force. Governing force is the thought, the ideas.
May I come in here, see? Nothing wrong with science and technology per se, as such. But when it becomes scientism, a total metaphysical worldview that only science can explain everything, then that is something un-Islamic, un-Quranic.
Can I ask a question about various points in your talk? You hinted to your view of Hinduism and the relationships between Hinduism and Islam in India over the last 200 or so years in particular. And you talked about, you were critical of Hinduism for at least two reasons. One is that it has a propensity to always assimilate another religion and make it its own and eradicate the distinctiveness of the other. And your second criticism was that there was a deep antagonism amongst Hindus in India towards Islam, which is one of the major arguments for partition. Can you just locate those feelings towards Hinduism in a broader context for me? Was it colonialism? Was it the arrival of the British which led to these problematic relationships, an awkward relationship between Hindus and Muslims? And before that, perhaps there was more constructive coexistence. Or have there always been major antagonisms between Muslims and Hindus in India?
My response would be, first of all, Hinduism is not a religion. It's a conglomeration of very different beliefs. Hindus themselves say it's not religion, it's a culture. And all who live in India should adopt that culture. They shouldn't maintain their separate identity. When they live in India, they are the sons of the soil now, so they should be integrated into the culture. Now, as regarding the opposition to Pakistan, it had two factors. Number one, dislike of Islam, but more so was division of India. Bharat was very sacred to them. They call it Mother Bharat, Bharat Mata. How come? India will be divided? No. So that was more effective. But there was extremist Hindus who had the idea to exterminate Islam and Muslims from the soil. They are foreign elements, they have to go out. There have been slogans in Bombay, Musalman ke do asthan, Pakistan ya Kabristan. Muslims of India have two places to go, either to graveyard or to Pakistan. Go away from here now. So it was a religious affair also. They had started a movement of converting Muslims to Hinduism. In the regions where there was no Islamic knowledge, some chief of the tribe accepted Islam and now all the people, but they didn't even know the kalma. First, you know, Ashhadu Allah ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammad. Even that they couldn't pronounce. Especially the Mewatis, you know, round about Delhi. So Tablighi Jamaat worked a lot for them. But they were converting them. So as to reclaim, they were from us, they must come back. Then the Britishers also, especially the conservatives in England, they broadened this gap and increased the enmity due to their policy of divide and rule, divide and rule. If they come together, they'll throw us out. Let them fight each other, divide and rule. So the oil was added to this burning fire by this British policy. And when they left a bone of contention between Bharat and Pakistan, Kashmir. Go on fighting, go on fighting, go on fighting. Remain friends, our friends, both of you. But fight each other. Go on, go on. The same continuation of the divided rule policy.
Okay. I have a couple of things to say. Firstly, I want to go back to your discourse this morning, and very interesting, very informative. What I was trying to reflect on was this, that we are looking at, in this period of 150 years, we are looking at Iqbal, we are looking at the thought of Azad, we are looking at the thought of Madhudi, yourself, and others. And I go back to the time of around when Iqbal was born, 1870s. And 1870s, I think, in some ways also becomes a historically very significant period in the British rule, because that is a time when practically, I think, in this northwest segment of the country, there are several movements that emerged which primarily were a response to the British presence, the British dominance. They did not like the dominance. They were also a response to the Christian missionaries and their work. They maybe to some extent were also protective against the influences of the faiths which already existed within the society, but primarily I think they were defensive. And in that movement there was amongst the Hindus the Arya Samaj movement which started, which became very strong. The Sikhs had the Singh Sabha movement which started before that. It was the Nirankaris and the Kukas. So the first 1871, the Kukas movement, the Qadianis and the Aligarh movement. All these are the movements which started at that point of time. I see there a trend of the thought that initially emerges from, which is I think informed through the works of all of them, like Iqbal and Azad and even Madhudi, where the thought was to find a model or to find identity within a pluralistic setting. You see, now somewhere around 1920, that period is significant because the rift between Gandhi and Jinnah, which led then ultimately to emergence of another kind of thought of separation. So I'm wondering here that if we even go back to 1930 speech of Allama Iqbal, he is talking of a very broad concept of federalism. He's talking of a very broad concept of federalism, true federalism, where the regions have a certain level of freedom and liberty, but they live as a pluralistic entities. Is it possible, in your judgment or in your reflection, that if Nehru and Jinnah had got along, we would not be thinking of so many of these things here today?
Well, these ifs, you know, they can have so many answers.
Yes.
And what I want to point out is that what you are saying about Iqbal is partially true. Because at that time, he could never think of independence from the Britishers. So what he was seeking at that time was the grouping of the provinces on the basis of population. So there should be one province of Muslim majority, you know. So that was practical, pragmatic. But then he said in the same lecture, for me it is destiny that an independent Islam Muslim state will exist and be established in the northwest of India. But that was not a proposal. On those conditions, nobody could think that Britishers will go. Had not the Second World War happened, the Britishers would have never gone from here.
Dr. Mumtaz.
Yes, sir, sir. You left the Jamaat-e-Islami in the 1950s, and I happen to have read your statement that you delivered at March Higod Istima. And I must admit that it's the most articulate and profoundly argued statement with wit and sarcasm and also with passion, and even today I think it remains probably the best critique of the turnaround of the Jamaat-e-Islami. I have two questions. Did you at any time after you left the Jamaat had the opportunity of meeting Maulana Maududi and discussing with him the issues that divided you? Secondly, at the same time or around that time, both Maulana Wahiduddin Ahmed and Maulana Amin-e-Hasan Islai also left the Jamaat-e-Islami. How is your position different from the position taken by these two other stalwarts of the Jamaat? And thirdly,
it will be difficult for me to remember.
Go ahead. But please do remember.
It should be a question, not a question paper. First of all, I didn't meet Maulana Maududi for 5 years after leaving Jamaat Islami. But in 1962, I was going for Hajj for the first time. So I came over to Lahore from Montgomery.
1962.
That was my first Hajj. So I came and talked to him. Then, Maulana, my difference stands where it was. Rather, it is more intense. But I love you. I'm thankful to you because you gave us the idea and all that. So I want that you also clear your heart from my sight. He said, I have nothing in my heart against you. But then, you know, that was not the time for discussion. I tried to discuss because when I went to Hajj, he also came because, you know, the founding session of Rabatatul Alam al-Islami was going to be held. After I left, he was invited. So I met him in Makkah, in Mina, in Medina, and wanted to discuss with him. I said, Maulana, do you not up till now think that some mistake has been? So he was furious. He said, the same question I'm asking you. Have you not up till now understood your mistake? So I stopped. Number one. Number two was, Wahiduddin and Maulana Islahi. Maulana Islahi was 100% in agreement with me. But his position was that had Maulana Maududi kept the environment of mutual consultation, we would not have left Jamaat Islami. So leaving Jamaat is something else, and the difference of opinion is something else. As for Wahiduddin Khan, he actually attacks the basic thought of Iqamatuddin. So he has differed and gone away from the basic ideology of Jamaat Islami, but not Maulana Islahi.
Thank you.
I also wish to say that I enjoyed today's talk a great deal, and I learned from it. I understand even better, I think, your desire for and your aim to have an Islamic State. And I understand better also why you do not accept Muslims and really Islam only being given in the States rights to practice their religion and other human rights, but not having full political rights, indeed, not having their own Islamic State. And I certainly do not expect you to change your views on this whatsoever. I wonder, however, if you can fully understand why non-Muslims would almost certainly oppose any kind of Islamic State, especially one in which they live and did not grant them political rights as well as human rights on an equal basis with Muslims. And also, given that you say, yes, you want an Islamic State, you're saying, now, first and foremost in Pakistan, but the real idea is to have either Islamic states around the world or to have the world become an Islamic state, then I wonder if you can understand why for a good many of us non-Muslims, that would only mean difficulty, first of all, but also probably conflict, because the rights would not be given fully. And if you're thinking of a world Islamic State, then that would be conflict throughout the whole of the world. So I'm wondering if you can understand that, which I think you can, but then what would you say about that? How would then conflict cease to be as long as there were non-Muslims in this world?
First of all, we hope that when a model Islamic State is established somewhere on this globe, most of the humanity and mankind will see the truth with their own eyes and accept Islam. But I don't say that the conflict will be over. There will remain certain persons, but in the revolutionary terminology, all the people in Russia were not communists. But they had to accept the communist order. This is the revolutionary force that establishes its order of its choice. And the other have to obey. This is the rule. This has been the rule throughout. But let me quote about Muslims. Not what to speak of Islam. About Islam, let me quote an incident. Omar, the second caliph, went to Damascus. And there he saw a Jew begging in the market. He called the governor for explanation. How come? When he was young, you had taken jizya from him. And now when he is old, you have thrown him into the street to beg. Fix the allowance for him. Just like the allowances for Muslims. This is Islam. The basic right that the Islamic Caliphate underwrites all the basic human necessities for every citizen. It covers the non-Muslims also. Number two, about the Muslim kingship. Let me quote Ben Gurion, what he said. The golden era of our diaspora was the Muslim Spain. In what a high position were the Jews over there?
One small comment there, if I may. That's only this, that I think the way possibly lots of these golden eras have been defined are such that the golden era of the Indian history in the last millennium is considered to be Akbar's rule.
Akbar's rule.
Yes.
And the Muslim ascendancy was at its zenith during Akbar's rule.
No.
But Islam had gone.
Yes, that's what I mean. You see, so therefore, I think to try and relate the faith of the ruler to the golden era possibly could be erroneous.
That is not our golden era.
Yeah,
that's not the golden era of Islam.
Not of Islam.
Yes.
But for the people.
Ibrahim.
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to draw our attention that the journal we edit in Hartwood Seminary in the past issue, the combined issue of July and October of last year, we published a special issue on Pakistan and Allama Maududi. And I'm sorry that we don't have a copy of that here, but we have like 13 major articles on Maududi and Pakistan, which are significant in many ways. Now, the question that I have is about two major events that you have referred to only briefly. The event of partition, the partition of India in 1947, and the consequence of the partition, the creation of an Indian nation state and a Pakistani nation state. Now, I want to talk briefly about the nation state of Pakistan. If I understand you correctly, you are saying from your own perspective that the nation state of Pakistan that has come on the heels of partition has not established true Islamic ideas and true Islamic rule and true imam. So in that sense, for the past 56 years or so, the nation state of Pakistan has not been a true Islamic state. That's
100% agree.
Okay. Therefore, my question is, within the partition, at least 4 or 5 million innocent civilians were killed on both sides. Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, all sorts of innocent people. Now, was it worth it to kill so many people for a secular nation state of Pakistan that you disagree with?
Brother, I was not involved in that killing.
No, I'm not asking you. No. True. But the fact is...
And neither the leaders of Congress or Muslim League
but that doesn't
could
matter.
Envisage that this would happen.
Yeah, but partition, the whole idea of partition, gave rise to so much killing within India and Pakistan.
From an
Islamic perspective, that's not worth it. To establish a non-Islamic state later on.
Break mental.
I agree.
I have
two questions. I want to learn, you see, but I may ask privately. Yes. The first question is how do you consider Imam Rabbani and Shah Dahlawi in your...
In Mujaddid, I have named the first Mujaddid.
Yeah, Mujaddid, but... I think, as far as I know, maybe my knowledge is very little and limited, Imam Rabbani, he didn't aim an Islamic state. So how do you consider Imam Rabbani's views.
I have said, you know, that the Islam during these centuries was gradually reduced to mazhab.
Yeah, I mean, and when you consider his views and ideas.
Also a private affair.
Yes.
Iman is also a private personal affair.
Yeah.
Personal piety. Uh-huh. That was the goal of most of the Mujaddids.
Yes, okay. Thank you,
only one fact. In terms of Islamic intellectual history in South Asia, Shah Waliullah of Delhi and Imam Rabbani Sirhindi, we have one major Canadian Muslim woman scholar on that in the USA, Professor Marcia Hermanson, who is known to some of our faculty in the seminary. Who's at, she's somewhere in Chicago, not in the University of Chicago.
She's
DePaul. DePaul University, who has done tremendous work on Sirhindi, especially on
Loyola.
Loyola University. Thank you, yes. So we are doing something. Thank you so much.